Hi, this is Bill Jacobs coming to you from the Channel 9 studios at Microsoft. It's April 19th, 2017. Good things have happened. We've introduced an entirely new version of Microsoft R, all of the products, and version 9.1 that we released today has some very interesting new capabilities. This video is the first of several we're going to do for you and post here on Channel 9. We're going to cover off the most important topic, I think, here first, and that is some exciting work that we've done in the Hadoop ecosystem. I'm joined today by my colleague, Premal Shah, from the Program Management Organization, and without further ado, I'm going to ask Premal to introduce himself to you.
Thank you, Bill, for having me here, and I'm really excited to be here and talk about the new features of 9.1 for R Server Hadoop. I'm a program manager in the R Server team, and specifically look at R Server for Hadoop and Spark and HDI. And yes, I cannot wait to share with you what we've released.
Let's talk about it. We'll get into it here. So the little backdrop here, the most important thing about this is that one of the reasons the Hadoop work is so interesting and exciting is, number one, it's a complex platform that's exciting to learn about. But more importantly, it's solving all kinds of new problems, and Premal will relate to some of our user use cases that we've discovered. As we've grown this product line, the ability to run the same R analytics on Windows and Linux and Teradata SQL boxes and SQL servers is all very exciting, and almost more importantly, the ability to blend in modeling in the Spark Hadoop environment where you've got massive amounts of data, but still be able to grab those models once they're built and immediately deploy them into SQL Server for an on-prem application like a CRM. That's pretty powerful stuff for enterprise class users. But it means we have to do a very good and powerful job of modeling in Hadoop, and particularly in Spark. And so we have invested over the last 3 years very heavily in Hadoop 1.0, and then Hadoop with Spark up through the 1X series with our last revision of the product, 9.01. And so I'm going to turn it over to Premal and ask him to cover off a little bit of what we were doing in Hadoop before, but maybe tell you about some of the most exciting stuff that we see in this new revision that was released today. So tell us a little bit about 9.1. I know there's some new technology kit in there that we think the data scientists are going to get pretty excited about.
Yes, I think so too. And if you look at 9.0.1, if you remember, Bill, we released six Microsoft machine learning algorithms. These are, you know, a class of its own. They're battle-tested. They're used in products all over Microsoft. What's more is that teams within Microsoft have actually contributed to these algorithms. So it's been a product of collective intelligence from all over Microsoft. So now we've brought these six algorithms to Spark, Hadoop, and Linux. So what that allows you to do is you can sort of leverage these, you know, huge Spark.
They were available only on Windows before, correct?
That's right.
Windows and SQL Server.
Exactly. Yeah. And now with Spark and Hadoop, what we're allowing to do is sort of open up the doors for organizations to train, big and complex models on large sets of data using their Spark and Hadoop clusters. So it's just taken the algorithms to just a whole different level. And we're hoping that organizations around the world can now use this and use the power of the clusters and sort of combine both these strengths to build compelling applications.
So, good. Well, why don't you tell us about the actual algorithm set? I think
you've
got a slide on that.
Yep, let's do that. So we have six algorithms. The one thing I'd like to sort of mention is RX Neural Net, or out of these. So we have fast trees and, you know, fast forests and single class SVM. But what RX Neural Net now allows you to do is actually do deep learning on Spark. So deep learning, as you know, requires a lot of resources, a lot of power to be able to build a model. And with Neural Net, we are making a foray into deep learning on Spark. So that's something I'm personally very excited about and sort of curious about how people will use these. I'm just thrilled to
someday you can give me your definition of deep learning. I think there's about 60 definitions when there are 59 people in the room.
Actually, there are probably more than 200.
Anyway, but it's all kind of neural network based stuff and different kinds of neural networks for different problems, and we're making accessible directly in Hadoop parallel at speed.
Absolutely, yes.
All right, that's cool stuff.
Yes. So moving on to the next item. So this is the, I think, Bill, one of the coolest things we're releasing in this product. So this is something called pre-trained models. So what we've done is, if you know about cognitive intelligence services, a lot of people know about cognitive intelligence services. But the issue is that what organizations have come back and told us, customers have come back and told us is, this is great in the cloud, but we would really like to have these on-prem. Because then we can sort of leverage the power of these models in on-prem, on our clusters, which are on-prem. And that's precisely what we've done. So we've got now sentiment analysis, part of the text analysis API from Cognitive Intelligence Services, and now they're available to use as a pre-trained model.
Can you give me an example of how that'd be used?
Yeah, so a classic example is call center records. So what companies have is customers call in, and they have call center records, which they want to be able to parse and figure out what are customers telling about them. So that's something that we've seen again and again, this particular use case. And now with this, they can do that, you know, really easily. These models are pre-trained again, so they have been matured, they've been tried and tested, they're from Microsoft Research, and they have tons and tons of data going in. So they're really, really high quality, and that's something that'll show in the way they sort of report the sentiments on
So it may be kind of a way for people that don't yet have the skills to become deep neural network designers and builders to start reaping the benefits of neural networks and deep learning for commonly shared problems like image feature extraction
exactly.
And sentiment without having to become the expert. And then, but they can train these models to some degree, can't they?
Exactly. So if you look at image featureizers, which is the sort of the, so we have sentiment analysis and image featureizers. So what image featureizers is allows you to use not one, but actually four, pick one of the four neural network models. Mm-hmm. So we have ResNet 18, ResNet 50, ResNet 101, and then AlexNet, which have been trained on the ImageNet set of images. And if you remember, Bill, we actually were one of the best in the industry in terms of these neural network models that we have created out of ImageNet. And what we've done is we've literally bought this on-prem. So you can use your set of images, you know, pick your set of images to actually featureize them using one of these neural network models. And then you can use things like, hey, show me all the images which have a kitchen in them. And you could, the best part is if you look at our interface also and the way we've designed these APIs is that you can literally featureize an image and then use any of the six algorithms that I showed you to train your model. So you can just, you know, it's like a pipelining architecture where you can just take the featureized image and then you can just push it to
a model. Why are we looking for kitchens? I would probably be wanting to look for an image that actually had the hamburger already cooked.
Absolutely, and that's also possible, by the way.
How big is the ImageNet database? I understand it to be huge.
Yeah, it's millions of images.
All tagged and described. The users don't have to acquire that massive base of images, house it in their shop,
exactly.
Label each image as to what is in it.
Exactly.
That's all done for them from ImageNet,
right.
And then they can retrain those models a little bit for particular domains.
Right.
In my case, hamburger analysis.
Right, and to sort of take one step forward is that when you predict, so for example, you train these model on your set of images, and then you want to predict, in prediction, the transformation of the image to the set of features is done as part of prediction itself.
Okay.
So you don't have to go through additional steps. So what we've done is we've made the end-to-end process of using these image featureizers also much simpler.
Okay.
And it's not cumbersome where you have to go through, 10 steps for you to be able to construct a model. So it's really easy to use also, apart from the power it delivers. So
I still struggle a little bit with the notion of neural networks and ease of use in the same sentence, but I'm sure you're right.
Try it for yourself, and I'm sure you'll hopefully agree with me.
There we go. Well, I probably will at some point.
Yeah.
So what else is in the
right?
Else is
so another amazing and cool feature that's coming up is ability to run pleasingly parallel workloads on Spark. So let me dissect that statement because there's a lot in that statement. First of all, what is pleasingly parallel? And so pleasingly parallel is sort of the same thing as embarrassingly parallel. And pleasingly parallel and embarrassingly parallel are two industry terms that are sort of used interchangeably. And what that means is that if you have a problem that can be nicely parallelized such that each node of your Spark cluster can handle a subsection of that problem in independence. So there is no communication between nodes. So that's what we classify as pleasingly parallel, because it's a perfectly parallel problem.
This would be things like simulation where you're starting multiple instances
yes.
with different starting conditions and you ask each node to work on some portions of that.
Exactly.
Monte Carlo is one of those.
Monte Carlo
easily fit
exactly.
into such a framework.
Absolutely.
So.
And another is, many models, right? So you might have many, many small models that you want to build on partitions of data. So let's say you have a giant data set, and let's say you want to segment that data set or partition that data set by a particular key. So how do you, segment that data set, and then how do you, run multiple small models on that one partition? And the whole idea is that for an organization or for a customer is that You want to be able to customize a model for a small partition so you can do much more accurate predictions.
Are you saying that you're able to model independently and at the same time predictions about what I, an old white-haired guy, might buy?
Yes. Yes.
Use a different model or a different set of parameters to predict what I would do.
Yes.
Versus what my 18-year-old would do if I don't turn off the data on her cell phone.
Precisely, yes. Okay. So you can have customized recommendations is a classic example for this. And the best part is that if you look at the way we've done it, is that we have made it very easy to use. So you might have your data in multiple CSV files, for example, which is a classic problem we see, right? So let's take an IoT type scenario where data from different smart meters is sort of coming in, where you're trying to predict, let's say, the electric utilization of a particular household. And they come in different file formats. And how do you take these file formats and just pipe it through and have multiple models built on partitions of data? And let's say you say group by, you know, a particular smart meter. Mm-hmm. So all of this is in a single step. So there is no sort of upfront data prep required. We have to massage these CSV files into a particular format that, you know, sort of we can understand. So we really...
So I could build a single run through that might create a family of models that would describe regions of the country, each model to a region, and run that all as a single job.
Yes, and all of that runs in parallel, and we can run like literally millions of these small models in parallel on Spark clusters.
This sounds like what our retail customers have been asking us for.
Precisely, yes.
And you had some other examples of this in other industries.
Yeah, so one is the electric utilization example.
This was the Internet of Gizmos. Oh, no, Internet of Things, not Internet of Gizmos. I keep getting the wrong
term. Right. The other classic thing we come across is, you know, shipping companies.
Yeah.
You know, they want to optimize. They don't want to basically send empty containers from one place to the other. Mm-hmm. So how do they use simulations and machine learning to figure that out? You know, how do they run time series to sort of predict the fact that, you know, I'm going to have empty containers out a lot this month. So how can I proactively then figure out how not to ship empty containers? So those kind of things. And the sort of the partition here is you might want to partition on location, because from some locations you might have more empty containers than some others. Mm-hmm. And that's why you want to build customized time series models, you know, based on certain aspects of
demand
this data.
For shipping services.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right.
Maybe maybe partitioned by routing.
Exactly, partition routing, partition by location, partition by container type. So that's another example.
So basically, this is an attack on the problem of if I have 100 different unique modeling targets,
yes,
I don't need to write 100 scripts.
Exactly, and the thing, Bill, is I think also that as companies want to build accurate models for very specific data sets, this use case is becoming very prevalent. You know, what we've seen is, you know, every second or third customer wants to build this kind of special. So they have a giant data set, but they want to be able to break it up into partitions and then, you know, run customized models on that.
Excellent.
I just want to mention one thing, Bill, that you can run whatever you want in this. So you can run models, you can run analysis.
Scripts.
So for example, airline companies, what they want to do is based on black box recorders, mm-hmm. they want to sort of analyze black box recorders for a particular flight. So each flight is really a partition of data, and then you want to run analysis on each one of them, all in parallel. You know, you might have like, you know, hundreds of flights. So that's another example that we see. So we're seeing this in across all kinds of domains, across all kinds of interesting use cases. So
Excellent.
So again, the hope is that customers can use this and really derive value out of this. So,
can I commit you to come back to Channel 9 here sometime soon and actually show us an example of that in code?
I would love to. I would love to.
We'll put that down. Put that down for a subsequent edition. What else have you got in 9.1 for us?
Yes. So, good. So this is another. Nice feature after the other. But this one is special because one of the things we want to do is really take the best of open source and Microsoft. Mm-hmm. We don't want customers to be making, you know, a choice that, you know, should I go for this or should I go for that? You know, we want to say that, look, you know, you don't really have to make a choice anymore. You can just combine the best of both worlds to build end-to-end applications. So what we've done is we've taken, you know, one of the most popular packages of Spark, you know, SparkLR and H2O, and we're seeing that we are now able to interoperate with Scalar, which, as you know, is our sort of package from Microsoft, our server. So folks, what they can do is they can do the data prep from SparkLayer using, you know, the nice deep layer features that they have on Spark data frames. And then they can actually just use the modeling features from Scalar. So they can, and then you could, maybe they can use a machine learning algorithm from H2O. So they can really build compelling end-to-end applications using, you know, any functions from any one of these three.
Yep.
So that really creates, you know, again, opens up a whole slew of scenarios that customers can do. So that's a really exciting, feature that we can't wait to see what customers tell us about that. So.
Yeah, and it's something that's come up with a lot of customers, and it strikes me that, you know, when I listen to what our customers are asking us for, when they ask for support of Spark, they really like the ability to look at a linear model in ML Live, which is accessible through SparkLayer, and then essentially horse race that against the linear models that are available in our Scalar library, because they actually have different designs, and sometimes the ML Live algorithm is better, sometimes the SparkR library is better. They have very different error and residual computation methods in those two. So even though we have two models that claim to be linear predictors,
right.
They have entirely different designs internally and lend themselves to particular problems. So this vastly, as I understand it, vastly simply broadens the array of choices that data scientists have when tackling complex problems.
Exactly, yes.
Very good.
Yeah. So
very good. What else you got for us?
So moving on. So if you look at the classic SQL guys and they want to come to Spark, and that's why we have actually fully embraced Spark SQL. But also, you know, with Hive, with Hive coming up, and you can access. Let me step back a bit and say that in 9.0.1, we released Spark files, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's true to our spirit of really going, pushing intelligence to where the data is. So we're taking a step in that direction and saying that, you know, if you have data in ORC files, you know, you can now actually read from ORC files also along with Parquet. So you don't have to go through Hive or any other mechanism to actually get to these files. You can go to these files directly.
Sounds like a solution to a talent problem to me, if we can bring SQL users to bear on some of this.
Yes, exactly.
I don't know what your experience is, but when I talk to our users, they tell us that they're still seeing, 70-80% of the effort in their data science projects isn't the data science.
Yes.
It's the data matching and mangling that it takes to get data prepared for.
Absolutely, yes.
Feeding into all the
It's a classic 80-20, 80% of your effort is going to go in data prep.
I wish I'd patented the 80-20 rule.
That's right.
Unfortunately, I didn't, and I'm here. So
that's all.
Anyway, so this does attack that problem.
Yes,
huh?
Yes, absolutely. And let me show you one. So another thing is we've done is we now have so merge support we had on local compute context, but now what we've done is we've actually brought that to Spark. So you can again leverage the your Spark cluster to be able to do parallel merge. So you can have again giant data sets. You want to merge these, and that's something that we this is a request from customers a lot, saying, hey, you guys give it to us on local compute context, but I really want to use this on Spark, and we said, it makes total sense.
So it sounds to me like we have a new solution for people who've been able to abduct one of their SQL programmers to help them with data preparation.
Yes.
And for those guys that haven't managed to abduct one of their SQL developers to become a Spark SQL expert,
that's what
we're adding the ability for them to do things very large data sets as well.
That's
so
right.
Whether you're the all R version of the problem or we're the blended R SQL version of the problem, we have support for both.
Right, and also before this came about, customers had to take a really roundabout way of doing this on Spark.
Mm-hmm.
So we just felt the felt the pain, and I just wanted to make sure that this is something we address, and make sure customers don't have to go through that pain again. So again, this is something that we hope that it has solved some of the problems that customers are facing today. So
great.
It's not on the slide, but I just want to mention that another thing we've done is also improved our installation a lot. So if you look at Cloudera and what we've done with parcel installation, you'll see a lot of improvements there. But again, we can deep dive on all of these in a separate session build. So.
Come back and have a code fest.
Yes, absolutely. I'd love to.
Right.
I'd love
good,
to.
Good.
Love to.
With that, I think we'll close this video. I think that what you can all see is that we're working very hard to extend the ability of our users not only across platforms, which is the heritage of Microsoft R, but also to embrace all of the goodness that's coming from the Spark and the open source community, because as Pramal mentioned, a key driving philosophy of Microsoft for our users is to allow you to embrace the best of both the open source world that is bringing us not only R, but also Hadoop and Spark and many of the capabilities there, and blend into that many of the proprietary capabilities, as is exemplified by the new algorithms Pramal has shown us, that arise out of the work done within the Microsoft research team. And I'm sure there'll be much more for Hadoop coming forth, and we'll get you back here for another recording and have a little code fest the next time.
Looking forward, Bill. Looking forward.
All right. Pramal, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you.
And so for our audience, I'd like to thank you for your time. I'd like to urge you to take a look at the next couple of videos that we've completed today that cover some of the additional aspects of version 9.1. And in fact, some exciting stuff that's coming up in SQL Server that also got announced today that may go a little beyond what we can do in R.
Yes.
And some pretty exciting work being done here at Microsoft. Thank you.
Thank you.